The Massachusetts primary ballots are set and are being printed. How will Democratic voters decide who the Democratic candidate for governor will be and the Republican governor candidate as well, and other statewide offices too? Will they choose based on the candidates' positions, their leadership abilities, their experience? I'm Bob Oakes with this WBUR Election Forum, a meeting of the three Democratic candidates for governor. Welcome to our listeners and welcome to the candidates, State Attorney General Martha Coakley. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob.
State Treasurer Steve Grossman.
Hi, Bob.
Healthcare Administrator Dr. Donald Berwick.
Good morning, Bob.
Over the next 58 minutes, we look forward to a discussion with all three of you about a wide range of policy concerns in the Commonwealth, about the qualifications that set you apart. I'll pose a series of questions. Each of you will have about a minute to respond with some follow-up conversation where appropriate after that. We'll be speaking with the Democratic candidates today, of course, to follow their party's convention this weekend. And in the next few weeks, we also plan to hold forums with the Republican candidates and the independent candidates for governor. So let's begin with this. People say that this race, the governor's race, lacks sizzle and that voters are not interested. Two of you, Attorney General Coakley and Treasurer Grossman, have both sought higher office in the past, but unsuccessfully. Mr. Berwick, you're a fresh face and largely unknown. So let me ask each of you, what is it that you believe sets you apart and makes you the person who should be the next governor? And the question goes first to Dr. Donald Berwick.
Well, thanks for having me here, Bob. I'm the most progressive candidate in this field. I have extensive experience as an executive growing a nonprofit organization to global scale and then running the largest agency in federal government by budget. And I want to bring that executive skill and that interest in improvement to the corner office. I also am an expert in healthcare. I've worked for 30 years to make health and healthcare better all over the world. Healthcare is 42% of the state budget. A lot of that is waste, and we need that money for roads and rails and schools. And so I think I bring to this race expertise in how to reform healthcare so it actually functions better for people. I'm out there on some progressive issues that I care deeply about. I'm the only candidate completely committed to single-payer health care, Medicare for all in this Commonwealth. It'll allow us to stand up for patients. It'll add many, many jobs to the Commonwealth and save a ton of money that we can redevote to other endeavors. I'm against casinos, as my opponents are not. I think they will harm the Commonwealth with problems of mental health issues, substance abuse, gambling addiction, and they'll hurt small businesses. The evidence shows you lose one job for every slot machine. But most of all, I'm focused on values. I want to end hunger, end homelessness, and really fight to end poverty in the Commonwealth.
All right, Steve Grossman, you next.
Quite simply, what I hope the people of Massachusetts will know about me between now and September 9th, day of the primary, is that I have spent my life both in business and as state treasurer as a progressive job creator. Took a company, grew it eightfold, earned sick time for all of my employees way before it was a popular election issue, and took that experience growing a company in the private sector, creating jobs, and took it into the treasurer's office. Created in my first few months in office something called the Small Business Banking Partnership that has poured vast amounts of money into banks that in turn have made loans to businesses owned by women, people of color, immigrants, and veterans. And I visited two of those just yesterday to see what growth has taken place. So I want to be known 4 years down the road as a progressive job creator, somebody who brought progressive values and experience both in the private sector and in running the treasury of this Commonwealth to create jobs, economic opportunity, broadly and widely shared. It's about one Commonwealth that levels the playing field and leaves no one behind.
Attorney General Coakley.
Thanks, Bob. And I think there's a little sizzle in this race. I think people are starting to pay attention to it. We've all been working hard around talking to folks on the ground, and people do care who the next governor is going to be. You know, I graduated 35 years ago from BU Law School, and I had the chance to work in a big firm with some good lawyers, but I realized early on in that job that big businesses, big corporations were always going to have voices. They were always going to get good lawyers. And I decided to do something different. I wanted to be in public service. And I started as an assistant district attorney and as a DA and as attorney general. And I had the opportunity in all of those positions and still to be the voice for people who don't have a voice, who often can't get good lawyers or are in the margins of society and don't have a chance to be heard. I've had a chance to sit with a family that's wondered, what's it going to be like with my six-year-old testifying? I've sat with a family that's now a family because we challenged the Defense of Marriage Act, and now they can proudly be a family. And I've sat with a family wondering, what's the future going to be like because dad lost his leg in a marathon bombing. So I believe that being a voice for people, holding Wall Street accountable, making sure that as we move ahead, I've been able to reach those challenges, be a voice for people, and say Massachusetts can be prosperous and fair.
Other than Dr. Berwick trying to make a distinction on casinos, none of you explained why you think in a line you'd be a better governor than the person sitting across or next to you. So I want to ask you for that one line. Dr. Berwick, start with you.
More executive experience and strong, strong knowledge of a key area, healthcare and healthcare reform.
Steve Grossman.
Proven record, both in my private sector experience for 30 years and as state treasurer in creating jobs broadly and widely shared for all the people of Massachusetts.
And Martha Coakley.
And representing people and, frankly, businesses in Massachusetts in cutting health care costs and energy costs and making sure we move ahead in an innovation economy.
All right, let's move on to the economy. It grew last year by an estimated 1.6%, but growth has been uneven in different parts of the state in recent years. What steps would you take to make sure that all parts of the state, including urban areas and the western part of the state, experience the same growth as parts of Metro Boston? And Martha Coakley, you go first.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Berkshire County, where our hospital closed, just reopened. I know when the economy goes south, as it did after the foreclosure crisis, Wall Street gambling with our money. I believe, and I've said this, we need to grow this economy by region so it works for everybody in the state, not just Boston and Cambridge, where great things are happening, but we need to work with what's happening in Merrimack Valley and the South Coast, the South Shore, with some great smart farming out in western Massachusetts, precision manufacturing in some of our old gateway cities. And I think that there are plans afoot already. What people want to do as the economy turns around, to work with your businesses, your elected leaders, your community activists in each of those areas to get rid of the achievement gap in our schools and make sure that we provide for the investment in businesses and the workforce by investing in our people all across Massachusetts.
Dr. Berwick.
Well, we need a fundamental commitment to regional equity around the Commonwealth. There are different problems in different parts of the state, and I've been all over the state. Part of this involves investment in proper transportation, getting people around, South Coast Rail, being able to build regional transit authority schedules and services that really work. That's very important to the local economies. Education and education equality is really important. I live in Newton, where 96% of the graduates of the high school students graduate from high school. In Holyoke, it's 53%, and we can't have economic growth with that kind of inequality in our school systems. We need to invest in certain things that are needed regionally. For example, in the western part of the state, high-speed internet, we've got to get that finished. They need to be part of the modern global information economy. And I think investing in innovation is absolutely key. We've had tremendous success, say, with clean energy here, 80,000 jobs in clean energy, 24% job growth in 2 years. We need to repeat that kind of investment in innovation and innovation support around the state.
Steve Grossman.
We need to fundamentally close the skills gap. That is absolutely critical. What does that mean? It means you need to align the interests of the business community, our vocational technical schools, and our community colleges. They have to work hand in glove. We're too siloed. We need to bring them together. We have 64 vocational technical schools in the state. And I just gave the commencement talk at two of those vocational technical schools in the last 10 days. To the extent that we can close the skills gap, invest in infrastructure, and fill the talent pipeline with young people, as well as older people who need to go back to school and go back to community college. I was with a man 48 years old. He works at Home Depot. He just went back to Bristol Community College to get his associate's degree in business administration. He's optimistic about the future.
So that he can do what?
What?
So that he can do what?
So that he can go from the third shift at Home Depot to work in a company, to become a manager, potentially own his own business someday. He has optimism because our community colleges are giving him that opportunity. But we need to make sure we close the skills gap, and that means investing more in our vocational technical schools, in our high schools, and to give the children who go to those schools the opportunities they deserve and the skills they need to be the winners in this innovation economy. And in schools that are in Fall River and New Bedford, and Chicopee and Holyoke and so many of the places where the unemployment rates are running double digit, that's where we need to focus. That's where government needs to be relentlessly engaged in closing the skills gap.
Well, let me ask you about focusing on another part of urban areas around the state, especially here in Greater Boston, that don't get a lot of focus when it comes to being able to attract businesses. Great neighborhoods for businesses attract other businesses. I'm thinking about Kendall Square in Cambridge or the Seaport District in Boston. But how do you get businesses to thrust themselves into cities and towns where they're reluctant or not inclined to go?
Let me give you a perfect example, because it's always, you know, you can't put rhetoric on the dinner table and feed it to your family. Let me give you a specific example. I met a German business owner named Bodo Liesenfeld. He is opening a company in Chicopee called Mank Windows, and he's going to employ between 100 and 150 people. I don't know the last time somebody brought 150 manufacturing jobs to Chicopee. Why is he doing it? People understand manufacturing in Western Mass. There's plentiful housing that's affordable. There's a wonderful new Voc-Tech school we just built. I chair the Mass School Building Authority in Springfield called Putnam. And he says, this is a place where I can come and build a great company. We have so many people and so many opportunities in our older industrial cities. And to the extent that we can align business interests, vocational technical schools, public education, and our community colleges, that is a winning formula to bring jobs to the older cities that have been left out and left behind.
Martha Coakley.
So in Cambridge the other day, there's a great ribbon cutting with Pfizer and MIT and the governor, because you have those partnerships, particularly our strength and our knowledge economy. And you look at Holyoke, where you have a data center, because the governor and the colleges out there and businesses say, we're going to engage in this enterprise. And what that does is provide a base for an old manufacturing city like Holyoke to then look at the mills and do the creative economy, redo their riverfront. They've got a great, aggressive young mayor out there who's trying to bring businesses in. And restaurants pop up and the businesses pop up. And the state can and should be a good partner in making sure, particularly in our older gateway cities, but in other parts of the state, that we look at what's happening locally already with those kinds of partnerships. And we come in and say, how can we help? What can we do? Tax incentives, giving people the opportunity to come in and build up in each one of those areas, those businesses.
How would that work, for example, in Mattapan? I spent quite a bit of time in Mattapan just a few months ago in a WBUR series that we did in neighborhoods around the city. And they thirst for jobs in Mattapan. And it's so difficult to get any kind of business that will bring more than one or two or five jobs into an inner city urban area like
that.
Yeah,
but we're starting to do that. Look at Dudley Square and look at, you know, that we want to create, you know, maintain what we have there. We have to be respectful of the neighborhoods and the businesses are there. But as Mayor Walsh, I know, is looking at how do you bring businesses in that fit in the neighborhood and the character that work with the people who are there, and how can the state be a better partner for that?
Donald Berwick.
Neighborhood development in attractive communities matters a lot. Watch what's happening in Assembly Square in Somerville. That's going to add 12,000 to 20,000 jobs to Somerville. But when I go around the state and ask business leaders what would make them stay in the state, expand opportunities, small businesses to start, they always mention healthcare costs. We've got to get those costs under control. Any governor is going to have to attend to that to make this a business-friendly state. We're the most expensive state in the most expensive country in the world. They also talk about being easier to be a business. When I ran Medicare and Medicaid, one of my agendas was to find what I called stupid regulations, things that didn't help patients, didn't protect anyone. I asked my staff within a week of being there to bring me 50 regulations we could stop to make it easier for hospitals and healthcare providers. They brought me 80. We have issued a reg to take away 100.
Bob,
and I think we can make it far easier to be a business in this state and help things grow.
Bob, because I've spent my life as a small business owner, I do roundtable discussions all over the state. I did it when I was a candidate. I do it as state treasurer. I did one in Mattapan. It was a group of Haitian business owners. And I did one up in Merengue Restaurant up on Blue Hill Avenue to a group of Latino business owners. And I ask one question. What are the roadblocks and barriers you face? And how can we in government help remove or lower those roadblocks? Then I have the good sense to stop talking and listen. And when I listen to these business owners, they say access to capital, reducing health care costs, technical assistance. I have a great idea, but I don't know how to put a cash flow statement together. Help me build that kind of a future for myself. And finally, reducing regulations and permitting. We listen to business owners. They are vibrant. They are excited. They are passionate. They've got ideas. In the inner city of Boston, we can help them. And I've done that as treasurer through the Small Business Banking Partnership.
And I need to jump in here so we can keep moving. I want to talk about taxes for a couple of minutes. I have two yes or no questions that I want to start with. First of all, do the wealthiest citizens of this state pay their fair share in taxes? And this is just a yes or no before I get to the real question.
No, they don't. We need a fairer tax system in the Commonwealth.
Probably not.
No, they don't.
All right. Conversely, is anyone paying too much in taxes in this state?
Yes, people at the bottom of the income spectrum can't afford the burden we're putting on them. We shifted that burden. We need a tax system which allows the wealthier to pay more.
Martha Coakley.
Yeah, I disagree with that. I think that we give a lot of breaks to people at the bottom level. We can't increase that burden, but I think that the first question is the one that needs to be addressed.
All right, and Steve Grossman.
No, and that's why the Tax Fairness Commission that Representative Jay Kaufman did such good work talking about exemptions, earned income tax credit, and property tax circuit breaker. We can do a better job for those at the lower end of the spectrum.
Absolutely. All right, so now we expand on that. What changes, if any, would you favor in tax policy, Donald Berwick?
Fairer taxes. There are a lot of loopholes and exemptions that are well documented in the legislative processes.
What's the most egregious from your point of view?
Loopholes that exist for businesses that say they're going to come into the community and add jobs, but they don't add jobs. We need clawback provisions. We need ways to make sure that any business that's offered a tax incentive to add jobs actually adds jobs. I also think fair taxation is important, and I will support an attempt to have this Commonwealth create higher tax rates for people at the higher levels of the income spectrum. And basically, I do have to go back to health care.
A true graduated income tax, is that what you're talking
about? It's worth that fight, yes.
All right. And Martha Coakley?
Well, I agree with Don in terms of the loopholes and the unaccountability because we give tax breaks and then we don't follow up. And we really don't have a good sense of what the effective tax rate is for corporations. And I think we all would probably agree we should take a look at that. What are people actually paying? Not just what are they supposed to be paying, what do they pay? What is the effective tax rate? And how do we make sure that we look at when we increase a tax incentive or we give people a tax break, particularly for businesses, is it worth it? And are we getting the dollars back that we should do to do the kinds of things that I think most people want to do in Massachusetts with their tax dollars?
Steve Grossman.
So I was part of the Tax Expenditure Commission that met and talked about all of these tax breaks, and it is absolutely clear that we need a policy that is ironclad, no exceptions whatsoever. If you get a tax break and you don't create the jobs that you say you're going to create, we have a right to take that money back. We haven't had that uniformly in place. We need to have that in place. Look, I put the state's checkbook online during my first year in office because people of the state need to be available and need to know how every dime is spent. And people don't know that. And more transparency throughout our tax system, more transparency by citizens, would give citizens a far better understanding of how we spend their money, when we spend it inappropriately, and how we can do a better job at spending their hard-earned tax dollars.
All right, casino gambling. Some people say it's a source of economic growth coming to the state. As we know, several companies have already spent millions of dollars in their bids for the three casino licenses. At the same time, opponents of casino gambling are mounting a legal fight to put the question on the ballot of whether or not we want casinos before voters this fall. Recent polls show a lot of voters oppose casino gambling. So whatever your position on casino gambling is, would you like to see voters get a chance to weigh in on the gambling question, Steve Grossman?
I don't think it's a good idea.
I
always think it's a good idea that citizens have a chance to weigh in and express themselves on the things that matter in their lives. So that's a fundamental principle. If people want to put a ballot question on the ballot, fundamentally they should have a right to do that and express themselves. This is kind of a complicated matter because it's now in the hands of the Supreme Judicial Court. And so it's up to the SJC to determine whether it's constitutional or not. So I'm going to leave it in the hands of the SJC. We're going to find out by July 9th whether it'll go on the ballot or not, and then we'll vote accordingly. But fundamentally, giving people more of a right to express themselves in matters of public policy that are going to affect their lives and the lives of the family, that's a fundamental principle I support.
Donald Berwick.
Well, as you know, I'm the only candidate before you that's against casinos and for the repeal, and I definitely want the repeal to go ahead, the referendum to go ahead. I hope the SJC so holds. Casinos will add a mental health problem to the state. They hurt small businesses. It doesn't make any sense. And for the record, I also think they, in a number of states that have gone to casinos, it's been a cascade toward online gambling, which hurts more people, more families. And I definitely oppose them in this state. I think it's a bad move. We don't need another set of problems. We're already underfunding mental health care. We already have a substance abuse and addiction problem in the state. Why would we make it worse?
Martha Coakley.
So generally, questions do get to go before people. We have referenda that allow for petitions, public engagement. There's a couple of exceptions to that. I know our office made a ruling on this issue based on the law, threshold issue. The court will decide, as the treasurer pointed out. I'm perfectly happy with the court wants to put it on. I'm fine with that. We made a call.
But your office suggested that it can't go before the voters because it would violate the Constitution.
On a legal issue, that's right, and that will be up to the court to decide. And they will decide soon, and I'll be happy with whatever they decide.
All right, so let me ask you this. Although, Donald Berwick, I think I know your position on this. Let's say that the court rules that it can go before voters. Which way do you, as voters, vote on whether or not you want casinos in the state? And Donald, since I know your answer, we'll start with you.
For the repeal, and we can move on then and create the jobs we need in the Commonwealth.
Martha Copley.
I've said I won't vote to repeal it at this stage. It's not the first place I would have gone for economic development, and I know that there are issues. I've worked with AGs in Nevada and New Jersey. We had to get a money laundering statute. You know, there are a lot of issues we have to keep an eye on if we go forward with casinos, but I wouldn't vote to repeal it now.
I will not vote to repeal it. I will vote to continue to see it proceed. Individual communities that want casinos can vote for that, and they did. Springfield is a perfect example. Many communities said we don't want it. But I fundamentally supported the expansion of casino gambling in Massachusetts for two reasons. One, 15,000 jobs at a time when 250,000 people were out of work. And two, $300 million of additional revenue. According to the Mass Taxpayers Foundation, that would fully fund, Bob, our expansion of universal pre-K for every 3- and 4-year-old.
But as the head of the state lottery, aren't you worried that casino gambling will impact lottery revenue, which goes right into local aid?
Well, it will affect the lottery. There's no doubt about it. But the Mass Taxpayers Foundation analysis, which is the most authoritative, said that net of losses at the lottery, there will be $300 million of additional revenue. Again, to fully fund universal pre-K, just one priority. So to me, And by the way, a significant amount of that money that we'll bring back here is money that Massachusetts residents are currently spending at Foxwoods, Mohegan Sun, and at Twin Rivers.
Right. Okay, quickly.
I agree with Dr. Berwick that we should not have online gaming.
All right. I think there's an overestimate of the revenues. The cannibalization of the lottery will occur. Plus, we're then going to have to put money into mental health treatment, support to communities and families, and help to small businesses that are going to be negatively impacted by casinos. That's a big overestimate.
All right. Moving on. This is 90.9 WBUR and WBUR.org. You're listening to a debate between all of the Democratic candidates for governor in Massachusetts. I'm Bob Oakes. The candidates are Steve Grossman, Martha Coakley, and Donald Berwick. A lightning round question, so to speak, very short answer to this quick question. Do you favor a Boston and Massachusetts bid to host the 2024 Summer Olympics, Martha Coakley?
Yes.
Steve Grossman.
Well, I want to take a clear look at it, but I want to make sure that in doing it, we don't take too much money that we need for other things and use it for other things. So I want to look at it very carefully, but I'm not going to sign off on it until I see what the plan is and what the taxpayers' investment will
be. So you're a maybe and maybe not.
Well, I want to look at it carefully. I think any society needs to look at big, bold ideas and decide whether they work. But again, I want to make sure that it doesn't take taxpayers' revenue that could be used for other things.
Dr. Berwick.
I've seen good effects and bad effects in cities that have held the Olympics, and I want to look closely at the plan before I take a stand on that.
All right, let's talk for a few minutes about guns. And first off, I'd like to hear from each of you as to whether or not you have or own a gun right now. Dr. Berwick?
I do not.
Martha Coakley?
I do not.
Steve Grossman?
I do not.
Have you ever fired a gun, Dr. Berwick?
I have not.
Martha Coakley?
Only in a practice range with police when I was an assistant DA, just as a demonstration of how it works, but otherwise, no.
Steve Grossman.
So I was in the Army Reserves, and I did fire a weapon when I was at Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
All right. With that as a background, at present, in Massachusetts, police chiefs can deny any resident a license for a handgun. House Speaker Robert DeLeo has proposed expanding that to give the chiefs a say in who's permitted to own shotguns and rifles, long guns. If this long gun licensing proposal passes the legislature, would you sign it? And what would you do to fight gun violence? Dr. Berwick, you're first.
Well, I'm a pediatrician, and I've seen the effects of guns, and I really want to get them under control. I support Speaker DeLeo's bill. I wish it would go farther. I think the one-gun-a-month rule is a good rule, and we should adopt that. We need to fight on the federal level to overcome the lobbying of the NRA that's really giving us policies we really even don't believe in as a nation. But we also have to focus on the underlying causes. Guns are a problem, but they reflect violence in society, and working on poverty and injustice and the things that are leading youth to not have options to participate in society. That's fundamental. It's partly gun control, of course, but it's also building a just and equitable society right across the board.
All right, Martha Coakley.
So I would sign that bill. You know, I'm the only one at the table. Maybe Dr. Berwick has also. But, you know, I've been to too many autopsies with people who have died from gunfire. I walked into Edgewater Technology the day after Christmas in the year 2000 with seven people who had been gunned down by an assault weapon by a disgruntled employee. I have seen what happens in our streets. I have seen what happens with gun violence. We have tough laws here in Massachusetts. I support Speaker DeLeo's changes to close loopholes around background checks, particularly around domestic violence. We filed an amicus brief that the Supreme Court decided this week to support the federal authorities' opportunity to enforce the gun sales that are straw purchases. That is a problem at a national level, not so much at a state level. And I certainly have spent a good deal of my life looking, as I think Dr. Berwick has said, some of the root causes of violence and holding people accountable when they use weapons. There's two classes of people who shouldn't have them, when they're illegal and when they're not stable enough to have them.
Steve Grossman.
So I would sign Bob DeLeo's bill. Think it could go farther. But I need to ask you, Martha, since we're talking about guns, the governor has proposed since 2007 one gun a month. This has been proven in the past.
One gun purchase a month to try and hold down mass purchases and straw purchases.
Well, to reduce the number of guns. I mean, nobody needs more than one gun a month. That's 12 guns a year. Unless you're trying to arm a militia, I don't think you need to buy more than one gun a month. And I just don't understand, Martha. The governor proposed this. When Virginia had one gun a month back in 1993, Doug Wilder signed it. There was a 72% reduction in the use of guns from Virginia in gun-related crimes. Why won't you join the governor and accept and support one gun a month? It seems common sense. This is the position the NRA has taken.
I think you've asked the question. Let her answer it.
Yeah, and I guess I don't understand why you don't understand, Steve, because I have worked in this field for a long period of time. I get an F from the NRA on this issue. I think we need to focus on passing legislation, as Speaker DeLeo has, on the issues and the problems that are a problem for here in the state. And we have problems with illegal guns and people who are unstable to have them. It's not the issue, and I think we should be focusing, as we have in Massachusetts, on our own gun laws. The federal authorities need to get rid of assault weapons, and we need to keep illegal guns out of our state. More or less than that.
Well, the fact of the matter is that we have an opportunity in our own state to do things that are going to reduce
gun-related
deaths.
Virginia didn't have the tough straw purchase laws that we do. They had a reason to pass those laws in states like many of the southern states where those illegal guns come into our state. So I'm glad the federal government is going to crack down on them.
All right. Out of fairness, Dr. Berwick, where are you on this, limiting the number of guns that can be purchased a month to one?
As I said, I'm for the one gun a month rule and would make it even more stringent.
All right, let's move on.
And by the way, and John Rosenthal and Stop Handgun Violence, they're probably the most authoritative organization in America on this issue, are 100% supportive. This is going to save lives. Fundamentally, Bob, this is about saving lives.
All right, let's talk about another area where lives are at risk. Another concern right now for both law enforcement and public health officials is the growing opiate abuse problem in Massachusetts, which New England governors addressed at a meeting here in Boston this week. A recent WBUR poll showed that 52% of likely voters consider the abuse of heroin or prescription painkillers a major problem in the state. 31% go further, labeling it a crisis. What specifically do you want done to address the opiate problem, Steve Grossman?
Well, the first thing I do within my first month in office as governor would be to issue an executive order and suspend prison construction in the state because, frankly, we are going to spend $1 billion between now and 2020 building more prisons. There are way too many people who are guilty of low-level drug offenses sitting in our jails, sitting in our prisons, and we've got to change that. We've got to take that money and use it for building more detox beds, more step-down units, more recovery units, more community-based care like Hope House in Dorchester. We've got to treat this epidemic, this crisis, as a healthcare issue and not as a criminal justice issue. That's the first thing I would do. There are other things I would do as well. I would like to bring more behavioral health counselors into public schools. There was a study just done by the federal government. It said that 13% of the 12 to 17-year-olds in Massachusetts have used an illegal drug within the month that the study was done. 13%, more than one of eight 12 to 17-year-olds using illegal drugs. So we've got to start with our schools, more awareness, more education, to bring that to children when they're 11 and 12 years old, because it starts right there.
Dr. Berwick.
I've set out some very bold goals that I care about with respect to disparities in our society, the end of hunger, the end of homelessness in this Commonwealth, and one of them is a 50% reduction in the next 5 to 8 years in substance abuse and suicide in the Commonwealth. We can do it. I've seen it done. We need to think globally. There are programs that work in this country and abroad. I've worked with those programs throughout my career. I want to bring them here. This involves also decreasing access to the gateway drugs, the pharmaceuticals that are now being used and actually calculated to be used to get people to hooked on them, and we need to.
Well, I want you to give me one example of a program that you think does work and would work here.
Well, there's a wonderful organization now called Shatterproof.org that Gary Mandel has started. Mr. Mandel, who was a hotelier, his son committed suicide, addicted to marijuana, and he has now left his former work, and he's started an organization that's working on statutory reforms, outreach and consumer awareness, destigmatizing treatment and drug treatment. And he set that goal also, a 50% reduction. I think we can do it.
Martha Coakley.
We do have a crisis, and I've seen this since I started in Lowell District Court in 1986. Too many people, for sometimes mental health issues, other reasons, become involved with substance abuse, both alcohol and drugs. But what has happened is that we have seen, and Dr. Berwick referenced this, a use since OxyContin, high-grade, very addictive prescription drugs that people start using themselves or take from their parents' medicine cabinets, use recreationally. And, in fact, we have had pharmaceutical companies that push these drugs for a profit, and they're gambling with our health and they're losing. And so we now have portions of the population that are 30% or so of people use those drugs are likely to get addicted to them. We have to stop that. We have to control doctors and pharmacies and look at the way they are prescribed, make sure that they're not diverted. And this is going to take a multi-pronged effort, and I'm glad to see that the governor signed an agreement with other states so we can work on that diversion across the New England region. Peter Shumlin in Vermont has said it's a crisis. I know from my colleagues in Kentucky and California, epidemic proportions.
Would you go after the drug companies in some way?
Yes, I would. And
how?
We did when OxyContin was being used. We forced, from statements from the DA's office and the AGs, have been after the drug companies to make them in forms that are not crushable, that they're harder for people to divert. And so I think they have responsibility when they're putting those drugs out, and doctors and pharmacies also do.
Quickly, Steve Grossman, you want to jump in?
Bob, we don't have a single detox bed in Franklin County, Greenfield. We don't have a single detox bed in Hampshire County, Amherst, Northampton. We're not treating drugs as a health issue, as a health care issue. We're treating it as a criminal justice issue. That is not going to get us to where we want to get. That's the reordering of priorities. That's what I'll do as governor.
All right. I want to move to marijuana. How well do you believe the state is doing right now implementing the voter-approved medical marijuana law? Certainly there have been numerous problems with the applicants, Martha Coakley.
I think we're not doing very well at all. I'd say we're doing disastrously.
What do you want to do about it?
Well, I think that if the public decided medical marijuana, and certainly everybody agrees people who have pain management issues should have access to it, but this has to be done in a way where we vet the applicants. You're going to have a lot of cash. You're going to have drugs that are still illegal on the federal level. And there are a lot of complications, I think, in terms of the neighborhood locations we have not thought through. We haven't vetted the applicants. I have said, and I think that, and I believe that the administration is doing this, is going back to take a look at it.
Do we scrap the process and start over?
I had suggested that we do that.
But you don't think that'll happen?
I'm not sure what's happening right now.
Okay, Steve Grossman.
Well, we passed this pretty overwhelmingly as a ballot question because the people of Massachusetts understood that people with cancer, glaucoma, other illnesses that are giving them tremendous pain, nausea, et cetera, that can be dealt with using medical marijuana. So I think the people of the state said yes. But I think the people of the state know that this has been implemented abysmally. I mean, it's just been an abject failure. That's what leadership is all about. You can't just have a vision for what you want to do. You have to be able to execute. And we executed this poorly. And whether we start over again or simply go back and revet, the fact of the matter is people feel that it's been unfair and done poorly. And that gives us a black eye, those of us in government.
So under a Grossman administration, do we start over, scrap it, or revet?
Well, if we can revet and keep this moving quickly, I mean, it's been a long time since the people of the state, people have said, do it now. It was passed at a ballot question a long time ago, and we still have nowhere near the implementation process. So whether we revet or start over again, we've got to do this right from the very beginning. That's what leadership and good management is all about. That's what executive leadership is all about, I should say.
Dr. Berwick.
Well, I'm a physician. I've seen how, for some patients, for nausea and pain, marijuana is the only option, and so I support medical use of marijuana, but this process was done wrong. I think we need to go through the vetting process again. And this is basically about public trust in government. I'm a progressive. I'm proud of that. But we need the public to trust the government to carry the ball on some of the really important and bold changes we need to make. When something like this happens, public trust erodes. I've worked for 30 years on excellence in organizations, how that happens, how reliability happens. That's what I've practiced, learned, and taught. And I want to bring that to the corner office.
All right, I want to ask a very quick question here on legalization of marijuana for recreational use. This is a very quick answer. In favor of it or not in favor of it, Dr. Berwick?
I want to watch what happens in Colorado and Washington for a couple of years. We'll have the data then and we'll know what to do.
And Martha Copeland.
Same thing, not yet.
And Steve Grossman.
I agree with that position.
Again, for those of you just joining us, you're listening to a debate between the three Democratic candidates for governor, Don Berwick, Martha Coakley, Steve Grossman, here on 90.9 WBUR and at WBUR.org. I'm Bob Oakes. Another very fast lightning round question, so to speak. Do you favor the death penalty for the Boston Marathon bombing suspect, Jahar Tsarnaev, if he's convicted, Martha Coakley?
No.
Steve Grossman.
No, I don't. I have never supported the death penalty in my life, and I do not support the death penalty in any circumstances.
Dr. Berwick.
Death penalty has no role in American jurisprudence.
And Martha Coakley, I didn't ask you. You didn't explain why.
I believed, although there were times as an early prosecutor, you know, there were arguments about for it, not for it, but fundamentally, I think since seeing through the 80s and 90s wrongful convictions with the advent of DNA, with the possibility of mistake, I've come to believe that we can't rule that out and that we spend so much time and energy on death penalty cases, we should be focused on justice for defendants who are charged, and life in prison is a subsequent and an appropriate penalty.
Moving on to education, can each of you tell us whether you support a cap on the number of charter schools in a district, and how should other public schools be reimbursed at all for students who choose charters, Dr. Berwick?
I am cautious about charter schools. It's a good idea to have some laboratory environments which are doing experiments, but charter schools should only exist and function if they take a random sample of kids from the community, if they absolutely share the lessons they learn, and I'm not for any for-profit charters. With those conditions, if communities want to increase slightly the number of charters, I'm okay, but I'd watch like a hawk. I also am very, very interested in in-district charters, Horace Mann charters, where we use the public school system itself as its own laboratory. Charters exist to help the public school system, and when they hurt the public school system, I'm not for it. In terms of unfunded mandates of all sorts for local school systems, we've gone way overboard. They're bearing burdens that actually the state need to cover.
Martha Coakley.
Yeah, so I'll build on what Don said. I agree with that, that we wanted to see best practices. They were supposed to share. I'd agree that lifting a cap means that we have to have accountability and that no way can either the students involved or the budgets be cannibalized by that. I don't think we should be having a discussion about either or. We should be talking about the ways we can teach kids to be excited about what they're learning, give teachers the leeway so that kids are learning the skills they need in science, technology, engineering, math, arts, maybe some recess would be good. We have gone down the wrong path in education, I think, and we need standards. We need to make sure our kids are learning what they need to learn. I've heard from too many parents and too many kids, teachers who are leaving because they're so disgruntled with the paperwork and the bureaucracy involved, and kids who are too stressed out that all they're studying for is a test. This is our investment in our future, is making sure our kids are excited about learning and learn what they need to. We got to get back on track.
Steve Grossman.
So I do favor a modest increase in the cap. That would only affect, by the way, about a half dozen communities currently. In other words, it's not so much the number of schools, it's the percentage of money spent for charters. I think it's roughly 18%. It would go up modestly in the new piece of legislation that's in the legislature right now. I do think charters have shown some imagination, some creativity. Longer school day is something that I think charter schools have used wisely and productively to bring the arts back into the classroom, to bring physical education back into the classroom. But you asked about funding. The legislature finally this year said, we'll fully fund the promise that we've made to these school systems for 1 year only. That's got to be a continuing commitment, not just for 1 year, but for each and every year, because it does hurt those more traditional public schools, only 3% of our students go to charter schools. 97% are in our district schools. So we're going to rise and fall based on the quality of public education across the board. And if we're not reimbursing those systems over a long period of time, we're failing those schools.
I want to ask about families in terms of education. The writer, Tom Friedman, argues that America isn't only falling behind other nations in education because of money, commitment, teachers, unions, et cetera. It's because students and parents don't take education seriously enough. So how do you, as governor, address the parent question, the parent who will show up to shoot a video of their kid at a school sporting event but then won't attend a parent-teachers conference and at home won't force their kids to work on homework and demand more of their kids in the home in terms of education? Steve Grossman.
Well, clearly parents have to be as involved as possible. Let's just start early. There's a wonderful program called Reach Out and Read. This is a program that puts a book in the hands of students and a parent or a grandparent at a medical exam. This is in early on. I think so much of what public education is all about and whether kids are reading by the time they finish the third grade at age 8 is determined by what happens in the pre-K environment and what happens between the ages of birth and 3 or 4 or 5 years old. So that's one key ingredient. You've got to get the parents involved. Second, I think kids have learned a lot. There was a wonderful story in the Globe earlier this week about a dramatic increase in the number of high school students who are choosing STEM education, science, technology, engineering, math. They get that in the 21st century, if they're going to be winners and they're going to have good jobs, good paying jobs, they have to declare early and have some science, technology, engineering, math in their education. But clearly parents need to be deeply involved. When there's one parent in a home and that one parent is working two jobs or three jobs, it's very hard for that parent to be deeply involved. And that's a societal challenge about poverty and deprivation that we have to deal with.
Dr. Berwick.
There's good evidence that when parents get involved in pre-kindergarten education, which should be universal here, we should have universal access to pre-K for 3- and 4-year-olds, the effects on the child increase, parents get back to work. And so reaching out to families is well documented is important. My daughter's a school teacher, and I watch her try to deal with the parent interfaces. You know, we're putting our teachers in handcuffs with this standardized testing and the teach to the test that they have to do, laying off librarians and putting in classes on MCAS. That's got to stop. And give teachers more control over the classroom. You'll find parents more involved. Teachers are not the problem. They're the solution. Finally, it is poverty. We really need to understand this, that a fundamental commitment in this Commonwealth to fight poverty, put it in the center of our attention, will engage people who are disadvantaged now more and more in all the things about their lives that really matter, including education. Poverty is at the root of so much that's going wrong in this Commonwealth and in this country, and we've got to rededicate ourselves to the end of poverty as a goal.
Martha Copley.
Yeah, I'm not sure Tom Friedman is right, actually, and I think we see trends on opposite end where we do have, as Steve mentioned, you know, single-parent families, parents who are working at low-wage jobs, both of them are working around the clock and don't have the time to focus on reading at home or homework at home. On the other hand, I think we see parents, and some of this is fed by the testing and the stress, and parents who are so concerned that their kindergartner get into the right class and they do well on these tests, and the stress I've seen from parents and talking to kids about, you know, making sure they get the grades and they get into the right college or they do well athletically, I think parents could back off a little bit and let kids be kids. Meanwhile, give teachers, as Don suggested, more leeway. I firmly agree that we have tied their hands in classrooms. It's not working. I talked to kids doing a computer science class in Malden, learning coding, and they were so excited. They said, Mr. Marks teaches us how to walk, and we learn how to fly. And, you know, all of our kids should be excited about learning, and that we've lost some of that in our classrooms.
Change of subject slightly or greatly, sex assault on college campuses. Do you approve of colleges and universities here in Massachusetts, especially public colleges and universities, are addressing the problem of sex assault, and what do you think they should do about it? Dr. Berwick, you're first on this.
It's a serious problem, and it appears to be getting worse, and we need to hold these colleges accountable for creating environments that are safe, help them do so. This is also part of a bigger issue, which is still the lagging problem of women's rights, reproductive rights at risk, the rights of women to equal pay. We need to understand that equality is not something that is a matter of degree. It's either there or it isn't. And I think helping women throughout the Commonwealth to achieve absolute parity with men is a key area of public policy.
Steve Grossman.
Well, zero tolerance. I mean, that's a fundamental principle, zero tolerance. That on certain college campuses, certain well-known, highly popular athletes get away with things that others don't. It's an inequitable system and situation, and it's got to be changed. But this is about training at every level. I've seen certain colleges have announced that they're going to do full training of students, incoming students. I think that makes all the sense in the world. Every incoming student should go through a training program and understand that, first of all, any sexual misbehavior of any kind will not be tolerated. And it will come down on people like a ton of bricks, legally and with all the authority that both the college or university and the law can muster. So zero tolerance, but also education, awareness, and training for every incoming freshman so that we get into a situation where people understand what the issues are and we can deal with them more effectively through training and awareness.
Martha Coakley.
So I was in the first class of women to go through all 4 years at Williams College. One of the institutions is grappling with this now in a very public way. We had to get together to do our Williams Guide to Health and Sex because they weren't used to having women on campus. That's a discussion that started then, continues at Dartmouth, across Massachusetts colleges, across the country. When I was district attorney, we have many colleges, Brandeis, Harvard, MIT, were all within our jurisdiction. And one of the problems I found then, back in the 90s, as I did sex assault cases and child abuse cases with some kids who were 16, 17 in colleges, is that colleges take seriously their in loco parentis responsibility. All of their students are, in their within their fold, but it became very important and obvious to me that many colleges didn't have the right processes with either victim witness advocates or reporting processes, and in some ways tried to discourage victims from coming forward, saying it's not a problem, we're not going to deal with it. We worked then with those colleges to work with the local police in our offices so that victims would have a fair opportunity to report crimes, that they would be taken seriously, that they would be dealt with both in the college and in the civil system with the police departments and the DAs if they wanted to pursue charges. We still have a lot of work to do, evidenced by the public. I think what is being reported now is not new. The only good news is that it is coming to light, and colleges have to work with their local authorities to make sure all students, men and women, who are victims of sexual assault on campus feel they can report it without stigma, they will be treated fairly. We have some work to do.
I want to ask if, as a Williams alum, you think Williams is doing enough. And I ask in response to some recent reporting we've done here at WBUR about a specific sex assault on campus that's drawn enough attention so that some Williams alum have decided to withhold donations until the college steps up, answers questions, and addresses the problem further. Where are you?
Well, I only know from emails and from following this. I don't have any inside information, obviously, on it. I think it is a good thing that it has become public. I think it's difficult for the young woman and her family. I give them credit for bringing the issue forward, because Williams and every single institution has to deal across a range of cases with policy, but they have to deal with their students and this particular young woman. I trust that the folks at Williams will, as painful as this is, look at this, and I hope that they will reach the right decision in this case and moving forward develop policies for victims.
All right, healthcare. Massachusetts now has almost no residents without health insurance. Many parts of healthcare reform in the state are included in the new national model, the frequently called Obamacare. How satisfied are you with healthcare reform in this state, and what would you like to improve, Martha Coakley?
Well, we know that we embarked on something no other state did, which was, let's keep our quality, let's get everybody insured. We were the model for this nationally. And you know what was interesting, Bob? We're the one state where still business and labor and healthcare providers and payers came together with government and said, not should we reform healthcare, but how do we do it? So they covered everybody. We tried to keep our quality up. Now we are addressing costs. And for the last 8 years, we have focused on shining a light on a market where there's dysfunction in the contracting by certain players in the market. We have cut the cost curve by legislation. We are keeping an eye on that through our Health Policy Commission. We haven't done what we need to do. But I believe that we are going to be able to continue to keep everybody insured, provide access and physical access for mental health and physical health. And I hope we have a chance to talk about mental health, but also to provide that quality while we continue to look at keeping costs as we go to more accountable care and more prevention.
Steve Grossman.
Look, there are many things about the Affordable Care Act that I like, the people of Massachusetts like. Obviously, implementation has been highly challenged. The connector and all the challenges around that, and the potentially a couple of $100 million that will cost the taxpayers of the state, that's unacceptable. Look, I think we're in the middle of a huge change, a revolution in healthcare. the way we deliver health care, the fee-for-service model going away, replaced by other models. We passed something called Chapter 224, which caps health care expenditures by to roughly 3.6% a year. But we've got to do more than that. We've got to incentivize people to use local community hospitals and community health centers, of which there are 285 in the state, which is going to cost a fraction of what it costs to go to a teaching hospital. Go to the emergency room, it may cost $1,200. Go to a community health center for an earache, may cost $100. We've got to incentivize people. We've got to incentivize people to use wellness programs. Every dollar that we spend on wellness saves $3.27. And as I said at my convention speech, and I'll say it again, I'm prepared to lead a conversation throughout this state as governor on single-payer insurance. It's a critical potential ingredient. We spend 42% of our state budget goes to health care. It's crowded out environmental programs. It's crowded out the arts and dozens of other programs that we need to invest in, including universal pre-K that's been mentioned earlier. So fundamentally, we've got to take a look at different models, because if Medicare spends 1% of its budget administratively and our private insurance company spends 15%, something's wrong. Single payer may very well be the vehicle to take that, flip it on its side, free up money that we can invest in things fundamentally that we need to invest in.
Dr. Berwick.
Well, I've spent 30 years of my life making healthcare better in this country and abroad. I know that we can have healthcare that costs far less and produces far more for patients. I've seen those systems with 50% of the hospitalization rate that we have, 30% lower costs and much better outcomes. I'm the only person running for governor that actually understands how to do that at the detail level, and I will lead that. We haven't gone far enough. Chapter 224 does not have the teeth it needs. And, Steve, I don't think single-payer health care is something for discussion. It's something to make happen. I think it's time to make this state be the leader in the way we pay for health care.
How do you make it happen, Don?
How
do you make it happen as governor? You need to build a consensus. You need the citizens. You need grassroots activism. You need the legislature. You need doctors.
You need to lead to the change and declare that you, as governor, will actually make single-payer health care.
Nobody can wave a magic wand, Don. You can't do that. This is not a monarchy. You've got to build a consensus in our society around any dramatic societal change. If you don't get the legislature, the federal government, doctors, and citizens in every Senate district in every corner of this Commonwealth involved in that discussion, that's what I mean by discussion. That's how you build consensus. That's the way I've done it as treasurer. That's the way I believe a governor needs to
do it. All right, let him answer the question, please.
A discussion is not a goal, Steve. I'm saying if I'm governor, we will move this state to single-payer health care. I'm fully committed to it. Are you fully committed to making this the first single-payer health care system in the country?
I believe we can do it, and I
Are
believe
you committed
a governor
to
has, to has to lead on that.
I would welcome you joining me on that, Steve.
Martha Coakley, single-payer.
You know, I don't rule it out ever, but I agree this is a very complicated topic. I'm the only one actually at this table that's been looking at what we've been able to do in Massachusetts and actually change the discussion here by shining a light on what's happened here. We have incredible quality here in Massachusetts, and I do not want to sacrifice that by saying snapping our fingers and saying we're going to single payer. You've got to we can see what Vermont does. Vermont does not have our healthcare system here and the academic medical centers we have, the research, the quality for folks. So I want all three goals. I want affordable healthcare that's accessible with choice and quality. We're not ready to go to single payer yet. And anyone who says that going to single payer saves costs automatically, I don't think is correct.
I want to ask, we only have time for one more question. So I want to ask this question. It's about leadership. It's pretty clear that all three of you admire the outgoing governor, Deval Patrick, but in the second term of his administration, there have certainly been some management issues. We've talked about some of them here already around the table, but there's also the broken Health Connector website, the state drug lab scandal. We've learned a lot in recent months about the trouble with the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, keeping track of all the children under its supervision. Big picture question, how would your approach to overseeing state government differ from Deval Patrick, Steve Grossman?
Well, I have a track record, Bob. I've spent the last 4 years, came into the treasurer's office, and basically revolutionized and reformed most of the things that I'm responsible for. And as many people know, I'm responsible for all the bonding, all the borrowing. I oversee the lottery. I oversee the state public pension system. We are literally going to reduce the cost of running our state public pension system, our pension funds.
I just want to make sure I'm clear about this. You're going through your resume again, which you did right at the start of the show, and I've asked how you'll differ from how your administration as governor will differ from Deval Patrick's. Are you basically saying that he has not been a hands-on enough governor?
Well, I'm saying that we've got challenges, and those challenges have to be dealt with. When I become governor, I'm going to do what I've done all my life, building a business, building Treasury, and improving the quality of life for the people of this Commonwealth. Roll up my sleeves, get to work, and make things happen. I want to be judged by results and by performance. And what's happened at the Connector, $200 million cost to the people of the state, is unacceptable. So I believe I will be the kind of leader and manager who will bring... I'm a chief executive. I've spent my life as a chief executive. I'm ready to be chief executive of the state, and that's why I'm running for governor.
Okay, Donald Berwick.
Government should run like a superb business runs. It earns public trust to do that, and you get more loyalty and the chance to do even more ambitious things. That's not the way things are going now. For 30 years, I've studied, learned, and practiced modern approaches to quality and quality management. That involves investing in reliability, very bold goals, proper metrics, and enlisting the hearts and minds of a workforce that really can experience pride and joy in their work. That's what I did for 20 years running the organization I started and built to global scale. It's what I tried to bring to Medicare and Medicaid before the Republicans threw me out. In some ways, it's the most exciting thing for me about being in that corner office, to bring what I know about quality to government and make government work for people.
All right. Martha Coakley.
So we shouldn't have lost Jeremiah Oliver. We shouldn't have.
The five-year-old Fitchburg boy who disappeared, went missing under state care, and then
later turned
up
dead. And so we shouldn't have lost him, and we shouldn't have. We should have had better supervision over Annie Duquesne. And, you know, one of the things I'm proud of as Attorney General in looking at what our office has done, and we do a range of enforcing business and labor laws and looking at health care and doing cybercrime cases, is bringing people into my team to say, what are the issues? What are the problems? How are we going to do that? How are you responsible for making sure that we keep track of every dollar that comes into our office? We get $10 back for taxpayers going after Wall Street, after the Wall Street crashed our economy. And you look at the results that we've been able to get, I think, for people in the Commonwealth, for people who need that voice. That is the skill, the talent, and the track record that I will bring to the governor's office. I believe that the governor's done some great stuff. We can do better around some management issues.
All right, we're a little behind. We want to wrap up today's debate by giving each of you a moment to give us any thoughts that you'd like to share. Martha Coakley, you go first. You get about 45 seconds.
Thank you. You know, I met this week with a young woman, a 19-year-old, who's working in a fast food restaurant. She makes $8 an hour. She has a second full-time job. She's trying to get her degree in criminal justice, and she wants to be a police officer. And she said, there are weeks when I have to decide whether I'm going to be able to pay my rent and my bills or eat. That's not where we should be in 2014 in Massachusetts. That is not necessary. And as governor, I want to make sure that we can make this wonderful state. We see the cranes all around Boston. We can make this state prosperous and fair for that young woman, that 19-year-old who wants a future here. We should be welcoming to her.
And Steve Grossman.
Look, the biggest, boldest, progressive idea that we've ever created is a job. That's what we need in the state. And I'm a progressive job creator, done it all my life, and that's what I'm going to do as governor. That's what this Commonwealth needs. We need to create one Commonwealth that levels the playing field and leaves no one behind. You asked about disparities in our society, Western Mass, cities that are left behind. We leave too many people behind. So as a job creator, I'm going to continue to do three things. First, to encourage business investment, because without business investment, we can't create the jobs that are the innovation economy, that are the lifeblood of growth. Number two, to invest in infrastructure, because without a massive investment in infrastructure. Number three, to train a workforce, to close the skills gap, and invest in people. If we invest in people wisely from universal pre-K to colleges and universities, and we create jobs, that's what it means to be a progressive job creator. That's why I'm running for governor.
All right. And Dr. Donald Berwick.
Well, you asked at the start, Bob, about choices. I think there is some clear choice here between two insiders who have worked in the classical government architecture and someone coming in from the outside with a wealth of experience in global, on a global scale, with improvement of important sectors in our society and a strong suit of experience and expertise in executive leadership. And it's a choice between boldness and timidity. Boldness means bold goals pursued without apology on behalf of a public that needs it. No to casinos, yes to single-payer health care, no to hunger, no to homelessness, and yes to the end of poverty in our state. Washington's in gridlock. This country is in bad trouble. It needs a beacon. It needs an example of a place not afraid to set those goals and achieve them on behalf of a progressive agenda. I want to be that governor.
All right. Thanks to all three of the Democratic candidates who've sat around the table with us today. We appreciate it. Donald Berwick. good to see you.
Thank you, Bob.
Martha Coakley, good to see you, and
thanks
thank you.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
And same to Steve Grossman. Thank you.
Look forward to coming back.
If you missed any part of the forum, you can listen to the entire debate at any time at WBUR.org. I'm Bob Oakes. Thanks for being with us.